Think big. Think positive. Never show any sign of weakness. Always go for the throat. Buy low, sell high. Fear, that's the other guy's problem. Nothing you have ever experienced can prepare you for the unbridled carnage you're about to witness. Right. Super Bowl, the World Series, they don't know what pressure is. In this building, it's either kill or be killed. Right. You make no friends in the pits and you take no prisoners.
No prisoners.
1 minute, you're up half a million in soybeans, and the next, boom, your kids don't go to college and they've repossessed your Bentley. Are you with me?
Hello and welcome to Turner's Take Podcast. I'm your host, Craig Turner, author of Turner's Take Newsletter and broker here at StoneX. I work with hedgers and speculators, producers and consumers. We do futures and options here. We also do structured products, OTCs and swaps. And for our hedging clients on the production or consumer side end user, we also do offer consulting services. So if you have any questions for me, you know what it's like to, you know, work with me here. I'm going to do a lot in the grain and oil seeds. Please reach out anytime. My number is 312-706-7610. Email craig.turner@stonex.com. If you're a client and you like what you hear, please give me a call anytime. You should also have my cell and should be able to text me too. If you like the podcast, please pass it along to someone. It's how people find us. If you want to check out my newsletter, go to turnerstake.com or turnerstakeag.com. It'll redirect you to my newsletter. You can follow me on Turner's Take. And yeah, I appreciate you listening and feel free to contact me anytime. Okay, let's get into it. We're going to start off with macro markets. We're going to energy. We're going to finish up in grains and oilseeds. Macro markets, central bank is the theme, inflation, recession. But let's start with the central banks. A lot's going on in the central banking world all over. Yesterday, Canada's central bank raised interest rates another 75 basis points. Really, and they went from 2.5 to 3.25. They have really been leading that charge, Canada, on interest rates. And with the Fed pretty much following behind. I mean, Canada and the Fed, the U.S. Fed, have, you know, both central banks have been talking about fighting inflation, having it more of a concern than some of the other major central banks around the world. They've been kind of going lockstep with, you know, basically for every rate Canada seems to do, the United States and the FOMC, the next FOMC meeting seems to be right behind. So Canada's now 3.25. I'm going to expect I expect 75, or not me, I mean, the whole market now expects United States, the Fed, to go from 2.5 up 75 basis to 3.25%. So that's kind of the standard bearers right there on fighting inflation. And when you listen to, you know, the central bankers in Canada and the United States, they're both saying the same thing, that you have to fight inflation first. Like, even if the economy is going to be weak, and when you raise interest rates, you do hurt demand. You could hurt employment numbers. You could hurt GDP. We can even go into a recession, but that pales in comparison to what runaway inflation can do. So, you know, the last time this happened, the United States is a great example. In the 70s, they kind of didn't go hard enough on raising rates, and they would raise rates, and when things would look to get, you know, a little bit better, they would stop, and it didn't completely, you know, kill the issue. Like, you kind of had to go, you know, really above and beyond to really stamp out inflation. You know, you couldn't be a half measure. And I think that's the way they see it. I mean, that really is the lesson of the 70s and the inflation there, that, you know, two. One, when this happens, you got to start raising interest rates, and you got to get, and that's the number one priority. And two, can't be a half measure. You got to see it out to the end, even when things start looking better. And, you know, you basically tell the market what you're going to do. You're going to raise rates until you get there. And, you know, United States and Canada will probably be at 4% at the end of the year, be somewhere in the fours the rest of 2003, and won't even think about lowering it, you know, again until 2024. And, you know, I don't think the Canadian officials were that blunt about it, but Fed Chairman Powell was, and it really seems like to me, no one said this, but it seems like to me that, I mean, the economists at the Fed and the Canadian Bank talk. Because they are really, it is really a kind of a lockstep approach that they're taking. You can see it also happening now in Europe. Bank of England I want to say they're around 2%. Europe went from a negative interest rate to zero, and just yesterday they increased, or this morning was overnight, went to 75 basis points. Australia recently went from about a buck and a quarter, 1.5 to 1.75, 1.85. So you're seeing all these major economies moving. You know, England and Australia have been behind the U.S. and Canada, but in front of Europe. Europe's finally, the ECB is finally getting on it and realize how bad, you know, they have no choice but to do this. The only one who's not doing anything is Japan. And you can see it in the yen. You want to take a look at a currency that looks just awful, you know, on a chart, would be the yen against the dollar. And, you know, they have stagflation and, you know, they're not doing anything with interest rates, and they experience inflation too. And, you know, as the rest of the world raises interest rates, it goes higher. I mean, the US dollar goes higher against the yen. Just in terms of currencies here for North America, the United States Canadian dollar pair has been just being arranged for a while. I've been saying it's going to be in the mid to high 70s for a while. If anything, it'd be a little bit lower, to the mid 70s instead of reaching 80, just because the U.S. and Canada are following the same monetary policy. When you start raising and lower interest rates, I mean, everything else is secondary. And as the U.S. and Canada kind of go up lockstep, that currency's not going to, I just don't see that currency changing a whole lot. Even if the U.S. has a bigger recession than Canada does, it probably stays the same for a while, I would think. The Europe situation, we'll see how that goes. You know, if the euro right now is right around par with the United States, if Europe starts raising interest rates the same rate that the United States does, 75, 50 basis points at a time, you know, that'd be helpful for the euro currency. But their president, the banking president, basically said, okay, we did 75 basis points today, last night, but it won't be as big going forward. Well, Canada and the United States haven't done that. Like, they're getting aggressive here. So I would still think if the United States and Canada keep on going the way they're going, they're going to go to 4 on their overnight lending rate, then they'll probably both keep gaining on the euro. So that's the macro currency and kind of monetary policy backdrop. What it's doing with the rest of the world is, you know, there is going to be a slowdown. And when you see the demand numbers come out, there is concern for demand. I think the biggest tell on demand is always crude oil. Like, what's crude oil doing? It, you know, that's the market that is probably the most susceptible to slowdowns in demand, and also can run quite high when demand starts outstripping supply. You know, it can be very sensitive to that. I mean, it almost sounds, I mean, you take a look at what's going on in Europe. I mean, that's one, you know, to the upside, right? When there's no supply, you know, how high it can go. And then, you know, here in the United States, you know, you look at crude oil come down like 20 bucks, you know, 15 bucks a barrel here relatively quickly. And it's, you know, a lot of it, we're not even in technically we're in recession. Some people say we're not. I guess it depends who you listen to, but, you know, the technical definition of two consecutive quarters of negative GDP growth suggests the United States in recession. Looks like so is China. And China keeps on doing these lockdowns. And that's really hurting demand too. You know, we've seen a lower demand in a lot of things, especially, you know, in energy though. Like, when you have these lockdowns, it does hurt the demand side. So we're seeing that, you know, play out in China. And here we go. We have lower energy prices. My thing has always been, you know, eventually recessions end. Eventually the central banks get inflation, you know, especially the responsible ones that are going to raise rates the way the United States and Canada are doing now, the rest of Europe is doing. So inflation will get under control at some point. When inflation gets under control and we start having economic growth again, and we haven't expanded the energy capacity as much as the world would like, you know, what does that mean with energy prices? Which is interesting because OPEC is cutting barrels here, even when crude is production, or even when crude's up in the 80s. You know, they used to do that, like, I want to say in the 40s or 50s, you know, when they had economic slowdown projections. So, you know, back then, maybe crude traded in a $40 to $70 range. You know, maybe now OPEC sees crude in a $70 to like a $120 range. I wouldn't be surprised if they did. So if they're talking about, just because they're talking about, you know, they know what the supply and demand is. They, you know, OPEC has basically said they can't increase capacity much anymore, certainly not increasing capacity here in the United States, especially on the petroleum side. So that remains to be seen. But for now, it's weaker. The stock market seems to be hanging in there. I mean, we haven't crashed. I think the concern is, you know, for a bigger crash, you know, to get a big crash in the market, you need a financial meltdown. You need a banking crisis, right, to really crash the market, because you have just regular recessions, you know, and then you have deep recessions. And the difference between the two is a regular recession is just a business cycle slowdown, while a deep recession is usually also not just a slowdown, but also centered around a banking or financial crisis. You know, housing can cause something like that. I don't know if it will, but, you know, and also all these economies now are a lot more interconnected globally than they used to be. So it'll be something we'll all keep an eye on. But for the moment, that seems to be off the table. The natural gas market has just been all over the place. It's a hot topic, not just for Europe, but, you know, with energy costs there, but also with fertilizer. It's something that we'll continue to monitor. But, you know, one thing we do see as nations in Europe figure out alternatives for energy, and you know, the United States can, you know, produce probably more natural gas. The long-term outlook is natural gas does eventually come down. But I'm not that bearish on crude unless something happens significantly on the energy production side of things. All right, so finally, and I still like looking at the June 2023 energy plays for when we get into next year's driving season, and I would think the economy would have recovered. I bet the Fed and central banks probably stop raising interest rates in early 2023 and just hold it there for a year. I think the Fed has already said they want to get it to 4. And they think that's, you know, 2.5 to them is neutral. That stops inflation. 4% sends it down, and you hold it at 4% a year. You can probably, it sounds like they think they can beat inflation down to 2-3% a year by 2024, by, you know, early 2024, by keeping interest rates at the Fed level over at or over 4%. And they're not that far off now. They do another 75 basis points here in September. They're 325. That means they only got another 75 basis points to go by the end of the year to get to that 4% level. So it's not like it's that far away now. So I think that's the game plan going forward. With that said, let's just go over into the grain and oilseed markets here. We've got a WASDE on Monday. I am going to be in and out of the office. I'm going to be at a conference in Miami, but I am working and my cell phone's available. So if you want to call my office phone, the trading desk will definitely be able to help you. If you want to speak to me directly, shoot me a text, call my cell. I'll definitely be around, and I'll definitely be working from the hotel on Monday. We'll be going to the conference later that day, so I'll definitely be around on Monday. I would say let's start off with oil seeds. The canola crop looks good. Stats Canada came out yesterday and said last year's crop was about 1 million metric tons bigger. That's a big deal. I don't know where they found all this canola. It didn't make its way into the balance sheets in terms of exports. Was there, you know, less on farm storage than they thought previously? And then the bigger expected last year's crop kind of helped balance that out. I don't know. But what I do know is, you know, it looks like Canada will have a pretty good crop here. There's no, they may have tight stocks year over year, but they may not have to price ration. Maybe canola is, you know, comes down another $100 a ton. Wouldn't be shocked if that happened. Instead of being like 800, be closer to 700. With the soybean market, you know, it's interesting. I talked to guys in the Dakotas, especially South Dakota, and that theme that you see from the Pro Farmer Tour, you know, the beans don't look that great, but the beans elsewhere do look pretty good, especially in the East. You know, soybean yields, maybe they're 51.5. I could see them being 50.5. I don't think we're going to have a, you know, a sub 50 I don't think we'll really be much below 52. There is a crop out there. Whether we have a 200 carryout in soybeans or 250 or 275 remains to be seen. It argues for soybeans in the low teens, my opinion. 12, 13 bucks. We're probably at 14 just because some of the other grain markets are higher and we still have to harvest all this stuff. You know, and South America is going to plant a massive amount of soybeans this year. And while the market won't come down yet, the farther along we get the year and the planting goes well and conditions are good, we'll keep on leaking lower in the soybean market. So, you know, I just think soybeans eventually get down to 12 bucks if the South American crop's pretty good. We don't have issues in the palm oil market anymore. Canola gets solved in the next 6 months to a year. I think, rapeseed in Europe is still a little bit of an issue, but the soybean market with this U.S. crop, which would be average, and if you just get an average yield in South America this year, you're going to have a record crop in South America. I mean, you got to remember, the United States and Canada really can't add any more farmland. I mean, that's done. There's no more expansion of farmland in North America. South America, they expand 4% every year. And, you know, Brazil's going to plant over 100 million acres of soybeans this year. It's Brazil. I haven't counting Argentina and Paraguay and the other countries. So that's a big, and 4% 1 year may not look like a lot, but 4% every year, it really adds up, especially over the course of 5 to 10 years. So I don't know. I'm a little bit more bearish on the bean market and just canola and oil seeds overall. Wouldn't be surprised if the corn to soybean ratio, dips below 2.0 as we go forward. So my concern is soybeans go to 13. I'd be selling soybeans here. If you're a farmer and you need to sell, I would. If I'm on the consumer side, you're probably still buying hand to mouth and waiting for a bigger break. If I'm on the producer side and I have an OTC account, I would actually be looking at soybean accumulators. I think that's a very interesting prospect. I also like, on the futures and options side, starting to buy put spreads in soybeans for next year's crop, and selling call spreads to finance it. So whether you use futures and options or OTC, there's definitely a strategy out there. Starting to price in 5 or 10% of next year's crop, I think it makes sense here. And again, if I'm on the consumer side, I'm probably going to wait it out. I'm not as concerned about soybean prices going higher. As you know, now corn and wheat are a little bit different here. So, you know, a lot hinges in the wheat market on the Black Sea. And we're going to finish up with wheat. So let's just switch to corn here. USDA Monday report, maybe we see a 172 yield. That's what the market's looking for. Sounds reasonable to me based on ProFarmer and the conversations you have and all these other surveys that are going out. That's the case. Maybe ending stocks are closer to 1.2 billion in the United States. That argues for elevated prices. And if South America has a great crop, and we can get grain out of the Black Sea, maybe it's not as an issue. But you got to remember, Europe had a pretty bad crop for corn this year, down probably 15 to 20%. So globally, we're still tight in corn. And the United States, we're tight in corn. South America probably have a pretty big crop, a lot of acres going in there. And the planting conditions are going to be decent heading into the year. But corn's still tight. And it's a crop that still has a lot of issues going on out there. The thing is, though, corn is a feed. You know, it's not so much as food, feed eventually becomes food, right? Animal protein, but it is a feed market. The wheat market truly is a human food market directly. 85% of the wheat in the United States that isn't exported is used for human use. I mean, there is some feed wheat, but a lot of it is used for human consumption. I would say on the wheat side of the market, there's two figures that I would look at to determine where we think prices are going to go. Number one is the major exporters, and I talk about it a lot. Like, what, globally, what the major exporters have in terms of ending stocks or stock to usage is probably the biggest determinant of how high prices can go or what range they can trade in over the year. And when you include all the major exporters, this is a stat we've been looking at for years, you know, we don't look that tight. But the thing is, we're counting some pretty big stocks in Ukraine and Russia. So when you take that out of the picture, you're like, okay, well, what does US, Canada, Australia, and Argentina, and you just take out the former Soviet Union, it's tight. And the thing is, the United States, as we always said, is the residual supplier of grains and oilseeds, or really corn, wheat, and soybeans. So, and if the United States is the last game in town, that's where things kind of get, hyperbolic, because, the United States has the highest land cost, the highest labor cost. They're not going to be the low-cost provider in this any kind of environment. So, then you say to yourself, okay, well, then what is the ending stocks to ratio when you take out the United States and the former Soviet Union countries, which would be the Black Sea nations? And when you take a look at that stock to usage ratio, that's the lowest we've been. So, so if you're like, okay, we're going to take out, if nothing go, if the Black Sea, if things go south and we don't get this wheat out of the Black Sea, we're going to go, we could have potential to go back up to the highs in the wheat market, because the world's really counting on this grain coming out of the Black Sea. Now, if they really turn it on, which I'm going to go over that possibility very shortly here, then, we could be going back, down to $5-6 in wheat. And this is what it really hinges on. I think it affects corn more than people give it credit here. Putin yesterday said that he was unhappy with the grain export deal and wants to renegotiate it. And what's interesting about that is I don't think they want to stop it. If they wanted to stop the grain exports, they would just bomb Odessa. All right. Clearly, they have no problem with that. All right? That's what they would do. They're using energy already to weaponize it against Western Europe. You can't argue that fact. Like, that is what's going on. They invaded a country. They have no problem with doing that. So if they really wanted to shut down the grain trade, they could. But that's not what they're saying. What they're saying is they want to renegotiate. And their complaint is that Ukraine is basically sending corn out to Europe. Right. The argument was Ukraine needs the grain corridor so they can send wheat and foodstuffs out to developing nations. A lot of these developing nations are in Africa and Southeast Asia and not Western Europe, which quite honestly is a quite wealthy part of the world. And if you're sending corn there, it's for feed for, high priced animal protein. Right. And that's their argument. And their argument is like, well, if they can do that, that one, that's not right. That's not, we were fooled or deceived. And then, kind of the undertones of that is that, Russia, if you're not going to do it, Ukraine, then Russia should. And Russia will be the ones to export that wheat. And who has a bumper crop this year? Russia, over 90 million metric tons of wheat, most likely coming in. They probably, you take a look at their storage capacity. They can't store all that wheat. And they need to get it out of the country. So to look at this from a cynical viewpoint, the way I see it is Russia basically now has this window where Ukraine has shipped a lot of corn to Europe, which, by the way, a lot of their wheat got out of the country before the war. They had all that corn left over. A lot of the corn was in the ships that are in the ports. So once they open up, the first thing they do is flush out the corn so the wheat harvest can come in, and then they'll probably start wheat next. I mean, just kind of the way it goes. But Russia can use that to their advantage and say, hey, high-priced corn going to Europe. You're not sending wheat to the rest of the world. Time out. We'll do it. I've got the wheat. Russia can save the world. And by doing that, they also kind of get around the sanctions, right? It's an interesting play. It's an interesting theory. That's kind of how I see it going down, because if they really just wanted to, if they wanted to shut down the grain trade, I mean, it's probably a push of a button and an offensive, and missiles flying into those three ports, and that's not what's going on. So my gut is telling me, Russia, again, is talking about, like, basically all of these financial, penalties and trade penalties that have been put on them, And they, you know, that's what they've been arguing for a while. So I think it's just another way for them to argue, you know, against sanctions, and to get more grain out of the country. And I think that will happen. I think they're going to be able to argue a way to get more grain out of the country. And if they do, then going back to my original point when we started talking about wheat, is the major exporter stocks look a lot better with Russia being a major exporter. And, you know, it's interesting. You kind of go back and forth there that, you know, Russia can get some wheat out and some of it isn't impacted by sanctions. But there's definitely, you know, the deal was set up for Ukraine. And I think Russia now wants to be kind of part of that deal, and get the same preferential treatment, you know, from that deal. So that's my gut there, on what's going on. We'll see. If I'm right, that's how it really works, then I think wheat comes down $2, $1, $2. If not, you know, and the grain corridor goes away and it starts, you know, we're fighting at the ports again, then that's definitely a very different story. We're probably 10, 11, $12 in the wheat market. So I don't know. Hopefully, hopefully it doesn't come to that. So that is, and so if I'm a, okay, so let's talk about trading here then to wrap this up in the grain markets, which would be corn and wheat. On the corn side, I think we hang around these levels for a while. I do think when you take a look at the price of corn and soybeans and what's going on, you've got to be banking a huge acre number for corn next year in the United States here. I mean, like, I don't know if we'll go to 94 again, but I can see 92 million acres of corn next year, 88 for soybeans, or 93 corn, 88 soybeans, and that kind of 88 soybeans and a trend line yield will use as much as we produce. And if South America has a huge harvest and keeps on adding farmland, that eventually eases, you know, all soybean numbers. Meanwhile, you know, if we have 93 million acres next year and a trend line yield in corn, we add about 700 to 800 million bushels of corn to the balance sheet, and we go from 1.2 to 2.2 billion. So you get the, let's say you get the Black Sea opening up again, you get a good crop out of South America, you start talking 92, 93 million acres of corn, 2 billion carryout. You know, I'm not bullish on next year's corn crop pricing. So I would be looking to sell corn. If I'm a producer or if I'm a consumer, I'd probably just be more concerned about the next couple of months and not so much next year. And then on the wheat side, I think, you know, the wheat, you know, it's, that's a tough one. Like, you know, if I'm a consumer, I'm probably buying in increments here. Maybe I'm going out, you know, for the companies that we work with, I'm looking at some of the wheat accumulators, because the risk is really to the upside if things go very south in the Black Sea. And if I'm a producer and I'm looking at wheat next year, we're going to have more wheat acres around the world. And I would look to be hedging in July for winter wheat and September for spring wheat of, you know, of 2023. This eventually gets solved. So I don't think the lows of next year are going to be the lows of 2018 and 19, but I do think prices will be, you know, a year out from now, could be much lower if we just get a cycle of even average crops, just where the math goes and the number of acres that are going in. So that's where we are. If you have any questions for me, give me a call. Again, my number is 312-706-7610. Email is craig.turner@stonex.com. You can follow me at Twitter at turnerstake, turnerstake.com. You can check out the newsletter. And thanks for listening to the podcast. I always appreciate a positive review, and I'll talk to you next week.
This material is conveyed as a solicitation for entering into a derivatives transaction. This material has been prepared by a Daniel's Trading Broker who provides research market commentary and trade recommendations as part of his or her solicitation for accounts and solicitation for trades. Daniel's Trading, its principals, brokers, and employees may trade in derivatives for their own accounts or for the accounts of others. Due to various factors such as risk tolerance, margin requirements, trading objectives, short-term versus long-term strategies, technical versus fundamental market analysis, and other factors, such trading may result in the initiation or liquidation of positions that are different from or contrary to the opinions and recommendations contained therein. Past performance is not necessarily indicative of future performance. The risk of loss in trading futures contracts or commodity options can be substantial, and therefore, investors should understand the risks involved in taking leveraged positions and must assume responsibility for the risks associated with such investments and for their results. You should carefully consider whether such trading is suitable for you in light of your circumstances and financial resources. You should read the risk disclosure accessed at www.danielstrading.com. Daniel's Trading is not affiliated with, nor does it endorse any trading system, newsletter, or similar service. Daniel's Trading does not guarantee or verify any performance claims made by such systems or services.